Okay, let's call this meeting to order. I want to thank everybody for their attendance here today. Looks like we have all of our committee here, our council here, other than John Fanning. He had called and said that his wife was having some health issues, so keep her in your prayers, and we'll continue this meeting in his absence. I sent you an email last week with an agenda, and also I had the minutes from the last meeting. I hope everybody had a chance to go over those minutes. Does anybody have any questions regarding the minutes from the last meeting?
Don't say it was busy.
Lois took care of that for us. She did a great job as our secretary.
Best minutes.
I'm hungry, guys.
Do I have a motion to approve our minutes?
I'll make one.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? It's unanimous. Thank you very much. I always want to remind you the purpose of our SHAC, our Student Health Advisory Council. SHAC assists the district ensuring the local community values are reflected in health education, instruction, and strengthens the connection between health and learning. In short, our goal is to assist the district in creating a healthy school environment. Today, our two topics are going to be mental health and school health services. I've invited Craig Besson, Assistant Superintendent, Wiley ISD, to speak on mental health. And our lead nurse, Lois Burson, is going to talk about school health services. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Craig Besson right now.
All right, I'm going to be brief, so I got just a few minutes. So let me give you a little history.
I'm going to warn you, his brief's about 45 minutes.
I need your brief to be
this is. I didn't even bring a note, so no presentation. So in 2018, after the Parkland, Florida shooting and Santa Fe, Texas shooting, Governor Abbott assembled a roundtable on the School Safety and Security Committee through the Texas Senate. And they started evaluating school safety, everything, procedures, facilities, et cetera. Mental health started popping up. And there's always been a little bit of mental health because it kind of had a little different connotation. Really didn't see that unless it was some kind of behavior problem, maybe through special education, but really no united effort statewide through school districts. So at the end, that was in the 86th legislature, and through Senate Bill 11, which was the most comprehensive school safety bill ever passed, and some other tag-on legislation, began to address mental health. And so mental health in the school system. So there's a little different connotation that I might say is when we think about mental health, we think about schizophrenia, psychopathy, you know, those kind of connotations. And that really does not apply, although it could be a diagnosis in these instances, but mental health is just the mental health of our students and staff, just generally. And knowing that through basically school safety, security, and wellness, that was playing a role. So that just the mental health, how our students were able to adapt to different situations was playing a significant role, how they performed and achieved. And so through that legislation and some other legislation, all school districts in the state of Texas are required to have a three-tier approach to mental health in their districts. And that is prevention, early intervention, and intense intervention. There's three stages in that multi-tiered approach. And how you get there is up to each individual district, but there are guidelines that do that. And so like a prevention would be improvement of school climate and culture. You know, just how when they come to school, what kind of attitude, you know, do you have anti-bullying programs? Do they have, suicide prevention? All the programs that we have at Wiley and have had for a long time, are those available? And when those students walk in the front door, do they feel safe and secure for the most part? And are they able to talk to someone, mentoring programs, et cetera? And then as issues pertain, so maintaining good mental health is not always about going and seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And so having just certain, I would say, safeguards in place that meet the needs of those individuals. And sometimes determining, you know, what the issues are at an early stage, as early as 5 years old, pre-K, because we institute all kinds of those programs. As you know, we have Character Counts, Bulldog Bridge. We have all those kind of programs throughout our school system that teach good skills, social skills, empathy, how you treat other students, etc. Those are acquired skills that also contribute, somebody's inept at those skills contribute to mental problems in some other individuals, self-confidence, et cetera. And so we try to work in a uniform, holistic approach. And so then if those students, and a lot of students come in, you know, they don't start at Wiley, they come from other school districts, other states, you know, we have a lot of transfers, move-ins because of the military, et cetera. And so we pick them up at whatever stage they get here. And so those students that maybe we determine that they have some problems, whether it's suicide, you know, is the number two cause of death between students between 13 and 18 years old. So and we see a lot of that now, social media, et cetera. And so we have pretty intensive prevention and programs, and then also recognition from our staff, total staff, so that we can intervene. That'd be an intervention. A lot of times, suicide or suicide ideation, there's other factors that lead up to that that have to do with some kind of mental awareness of our kids. And so, and then we do have some students that might progress from that early intervention to more of an intense intervention. And so one of the things that Wiley has done several years ago is we had one licensed special school psychologist. We went to four immediately. So, you know, our thought pattern, my thought was, when we have students in crisis, and we have counselors at most of our campuses, but counselor training is not always about crisis training. And, you know, they deal with day-to-day issues that students may or may not have, but maybe those might be outside their training and expertise. And so I wanted someone, you know, if we had a student that was riding the bus to school in the morning and said, I want to kill myself, I wanted to have somebody there when that student got off that bus, when that bus driver let us know, pulls up in front of whatever campus it is, I got somebody with training that could get that student right there, whether they're 5 years old or 18 years old, and start dealing with it right then. And, you know, administrators, et cetera, that's a little bit out of our comfort zone. And so we started with LSSPs, where we learned that that's a little bit of sword in that too, because they're not all trained in all those kind of crisis positions. We had Alyssa Brown here at the high school, who really, we started talking about this three-tier program even before it was officially a law. We had a little bit to do with putting that into Senate Bill 11, but she developed that plan, and then now she's gone to the Metroplex. And so now we have Rick Sanders, who is a licensed professional counselor, which actually has really played into that even better than that, because he has that crisis training, and he knows, he really has been using those kind of programs and those tier developments through his whole career. He had an education base, then he went private practice, now he's back in education. So it's opened up a whole nother expertise, I think, especially from me, a novice, and I'm trying to say, this is what I want, I know what we want, but I don't really know that, but I'm not a mental health expert. So he's brought a lot to the table on that. We just want to make sure that once we identify a student, whatever that is, that we have some kind of intervention in a course within the school system, because for many, many years we did not. We just counseled them, called the parents and said, hey, something's going on. And most of them, if insurance didn't cover it, they didn't go to Betty Hardwick, or there wasn't even a licensed school psychiatrist in Abilene, so you have to go to Lubbock or the Metroplex, and there really was no outreach. And so we think now that's important. That's for the best of everybody in our district, to have those available. And we also are a member of the Texas Tech Mental Health. They have a consortium now that was part of our program through Governor Abbott. It started out, they had 10 school districts in the panhandle, and basically it's a telemed process that enables small school districts, with the first 10 that were in there, when they had those systems before, if they didn't have LSSPs or licensed professionals, they didn't have that access, they could call in confidentially and get some kind of advice. And it's grown statewide, and there's four major universities that Governor Abbott put in charge in their own regions. And so we actually have an LPC that comes out with making a visit once we have a referral into that. Would make a referral, and then we can actually, through Zoom conferencing and with, you know, consent from parents, are able to have an actual psychiatrist can visit with that student, and they have up to five visits, and it's free. Charge doesn't cost anything to those students. And so, you know, Rick and our other LSSPs are all kind of schooled, and this is our second year, and it's really was aimed at fourth grade and above, but they have a kind of an alternative program that really wasn't set up through the legislation that actually we can use pre-K through third grade too. Because, you know, they have issues too, behavior. Mostly we see it in acting out behavior, but sometimes it's a little deeper issue once we get under the skin. So we have some different areas to do that. And it's being, you know, we're kind of rural out here. There's not a tremendous amount of that help personnel outside of the school system. So Mr. Light, you know, personnel is always, you know, an expensive venture and finding them with qualified people, but he, you know, he was able to jump on that when we said, I said, this is really what we, the direction we need to go to be safe and secure and to meet the needs of our students. And then Betty Hardwick's worked good with us too in that also. So we also teach all of our staff that interacts regularly, our teachers and our aides, get trained in mental health first aid, youth mental health first aid, which is a nationally approved program. We actually partnered with Betty Hardwick to have four of our instructors here trained. They used to all have a counseling background or their LSSPs, kind of a stringent program and be able to get that. Betty Hardwick had a grant for $30,000 because of national trainers come in. We have four people trained, but there's a limited number of people they can train at one session. So we have, you know, almost 700 employees, about 400 that meet that A teacher category. And so we have trained a good portion of them. And then we have new staff, about 100 new staff every year. About half of those meet that criteria. So we're training all the time. And then we're trying, you know, if one of those trainers leaves, then we have to train somebody else. So, but we think that's important. It's a once every 3 years to retain a youth mental health first aid certificate. We actually only going to require one-time training, and then we'll do a review every year. If you want to keep a certificate, if you're a counselor or a health professional, and you want to have that, it's not required by the state. But we also do trauma-informed care, and that's another federally certified program, that we do that one-time training and then we review every year. So you know, teachers have gone a little bit outside their comfort zone from, you know, arithmetic and reading and the mental health. So but it all pays off in the end when you understand why somebody's misbehaving, or they're not coming to school, or they're not turning in the work, or they won't talk, or they won't correspond. If you at least know enough to know which direction we're going, where you know, who do we refer them to, who do I talk to. And, you know, we have issues. We had an issue this week. So that all plays into that, safety and security. And you know, our students that have those kind of things, those thoughts, et cetera, they're having some kind of crisis somewhere at some time. It's usually not an immediate thing. It's something that's manifested over time. And the sooner we get there, the better off we are. And that's why we have communities in school, mentor care, all those great programs to find those needs and identify them, and then get them to Rick Sanders, get them to our LSSPs, whatever it is.
Can you explain mentor care to us?
Mentor care is a program we started this year at the high school. So one of the things that in safety and security and even mental illness, et cetera, causes students to maybe go on a pathway to violence or hurt themselves or others has to do with having a personal relationship with an adult other than their parents. And the data shows that those individuals that have that relationship, somebody they can just talk to, trust, doesn't have to be really in-depth, it could be a teacher, it could be a coach, it could be anybody that, you know, can mentor them to some degree, that their chances of staying off that path or coming back straight on greatly increases. And those that maybe take that downward spiral on that pathway to violence or that problem area have had a cease in that relationship or never had one. And so finding that's a lot of times, even though we may not know, you know, we don't know where our kids are, or if they are, or where they're at. You never know when you're going to make them change, what event is going to change them from, you know, not every kid's going to be a school shooter, but you know, they might be a bad husband, or they might be a criminal, or a lot of things. And that's a pathway. We don't want them to go on that pathway. So anything we can do that changes that, we don't even know when it happens most of the time, but we just got to keep trying. And because you don't know, because that one that you don't change then that's when you have bad repercussions. That's when bad things happen. And some slip through the cracks. And we have mitigation, et cetera, in place to address that. But it's a whole lot easier to try to fix it on the front end, fix it on the back end, I can assure you. And you just can't have too many. We have communities in school. That's a similar deal. It's more of a group setting. But, you know, when you only have a limited number of just regular counselors, you know, that line could be up down the hall every day. It's a crisis when you have a developing mind and a brain. You know, a child's brain doesn't mature till they're in their 20s. So everything's a crisis. I can't get my homework. She won't talk to me. I didn't make the first team. Whatever is a crisis. And it's the most important thing that happens to them that day. And it's monumental. We can adjust to that because we're adults. We've learned to compensate, but they don't have those skills. And so addressing those needs and saying, this is how you compensate, this is how you deal with it, this is how you have empathy, etc., that's important. And those are skills with so much information that our students are bombarded with, social media, it's fast, immediate. We have to take a different approach to address those needs. And it's hard when you're a parent because you don't see them. I mean, they're gone 8-9 hours a day. They're up here, and you say, hey, I'm still great. All right, you need help? Yeah, everything's good. That's kind of where you're at. Where they might tell that mentor or that counselor or that somebody else, you know, my life's terrible, or so-and-so, they might open up. Sometimes it's a school nurse. They see a lot of those issues because the kids, they just can't go to class. They can't deal with it, so they have a stomachache or they have a headache. And they can tell you they have regulars in there all the time, and that's what it is. They want a little bit of safety, you know, a little bit of comforting, and then we go back and we try to do it again. And so when they have repeat offenders, they can identify that too. It's the same thing.
We have a lot of adults in this community could be great mentors, and many of them volunteer, and they come in once a week and they meet with their student 1 hour a week. We make sure that we protect instruction time, so we try to take them out of a PE or an elective, and once a week they come in.
It's a structure. They have a curriculum. I mean, they don't just start talking. So they're trying to have a structured curriculum. Our goal was 20 the first year, and we're way over that. No,
50-something.
So, and that's such a great – and you would – we got that many kids, though. We've got that many kids.
I was going to say, somebody. For anybody that's actually in line for the counseling, you've got hundreds of others that really could benefit from it.
And, you know, that's the three-tier approach that we have, that bottom tier, that, you know, that prevention, all that's really an open book. Part of that was just recognizing, you know, giving somebody some place to go. Maybe you're having a function, you're having a whatever, to have kids that are trying to find somewhere to go and talk to, give them a place to get in before they get in a crisis. Because once they're in a crisis, then we know they're tier two, we're doing some intervention. So, you know, it's a lot better when you kind of get on the front end before it gets too deep. But, you know, we're prepared to go on that. So.
The mentor care is absolutely incredible. I'm a newbie over there as well. I had my second week earlier this week, or my second meeting. And it's beneficial for me as I get probably as much, if not more, than my student does.
So. Where do they allow y'all to meet? Do they go in the library? I've seen that
library. There's a couple conference rooms we can use. It really depends on the student where they feel most comfortable.
Do you need a private location?
Private, but it's a public private.
Right.
Because we're not supposed to be behind closed doors kind of thing. But we also want the confidentiality to have him to be able to, or he or she to
talk,
open up.
Open up?
Absolutely.
Just talk and listen. Talk and listen. It's so important.
And I think it's great for community members, because if you're not in the school system, you don't realize, like, these kids are dealing with a lot.
Well, and this is our investment.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It takes a village to raise a child. And if parents believe that the teachers and administration are the only ones that teaching their children, and they're sorely mistaken.
This gentleman out here just stepped up with my children, so I agree with you.
As well.
Yep.
I love that you talked about the trauma informed.
Yep, training. We do a lot. You know, that's initial. All new employees go through that training.
What is that? Where does that come from?
Family and FD with Texas Family something. whatever it is. We have an approved training from DEA. Yeah. It's a short, it's an online course.
Okay.
And then, you know, we do a yearly review at the first of the year.
Yeah.
We're doing kind of an all-day training now.
Yeah, I was fixing to touch upon that. Mr. Besson's taking the lead on us. He's done a great job because we hire a lot of people after all this first. We do new employee orientation. Well, in years past, we waited a full year. And sometimes we even miss them again, but now we're training twice a year. So we put in our professional development in January and February to retrain or train people.
And most of this stuff is in statute, so it's in, now it's, you know, it's required. So keeping up with who has what, that's we're kind of making sure.
We're improving on that.
Dotting the I's, crossing the T's, make sure everybody, you know, has what they're required to have. And then, if you know, it's always good. If a lot of it's perishable skill. I mean, everybody's in a crunch at the start of school, but
sure.
It's important. You know, that's kind of starts your year off, and we don't have to go through, if you've been through my try and do a whole day of safety training and spend a lot of time talking about those things. We do stop the bleed, some other things. And then they're required to go online. We have a staff portal that does all their other trainings. And then we think it's important that we review a little bit, so we're going to spend a day reviewing all safety, mental health, suicide.
600-plus people are going to be in the pack, and they think we're just going to do our normal back-to-school meetings, but we're going to do all these refreshers.
I just think it's, you know, you can't expect your staff to know, understand those. And I do it really fast. You know, I mean, like, my presentation, but I think it's important. That said, you know, even academics is important. All that's important, but your school climate culture is number one thing.
Yeah.
And if students, you know, data shows if they feel safe and secure, they learn better, achieve better, and misbehave less. Just a standard thing. So, you know, it just pays for us to do that, I think.
You know, think about the trauma training is so powerful because you don't know from the outside, you know, that this is from a place of trauma. You don't know just at a glance in a classroom which of your kiddos is coming from a place where that has taken place. And so, you know, the surface is you really don't want to do this homework, or you really don't want to, you know, listen or not respect the floor, you know, whatever the thing is. The reality is that that kid's not even in the room. They're glazed over, they're gone.
Yep.
So
they compensate. They find, they go somewhere in their brain or find them. So it's a holistic view. I can tell you, it's been quite a change for me, you know, being safety and security for a long time. And I'd be in Austin, and we'd be talking, and always these people kept getting up talking about mental health and relationships, you know, that mentors type relationship. And I would drive home, and my wife would be sitting there, and I'd say, I don't know why those people keep getting up and talking. We need, you know, better security festivals, and we need better, faster response time. And I just kept hearing it. And finally, I started like, you know, it just like, all of a sudden, I said, you know, that's really, I mean, we can mitigate all, I really don't want to have to mitigate. I'd rather stop it on that front end. And so, you know, it was a slow process, but I'm getting educated every time I go. So there's a lot of people that, you know more about it than me. I just try to facilitate. And, you know, I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, it changes a lot. And we're not in a session right now, but you know, we're still working on new things, I can assure you. All the time, I've got a meeting Monday morning, 8:30, with Governor Abbott, so he wants to talk about school safety, what we're doing. And I don't know what he's going to talk about, but he'll tell me something. Because somebody's probably talked to him, and he'll say, you know, sometimes he wants to know, you know, where we at on mental health, or where are we at on this, or, what do you, he'll have a plan. He'll have an idea that he wants to put out there. So, and he's got good advice. Good people talk to him about it. So it'll be, and I never know. I just take a notepad. Right in the middle of the first of Christmas, I'll take it. Okay.
That's right.
That's
good.
Any further questions for Craig? Thank you for being very thorough.
Yeah,
thank you.
It'll be a hard act to follow.
I know. I brought my can tell he's done this a few times.
Talk to us about school health services.
Okay, I'll give you my little PowerPoint. It's something.
Sure.
I didn't staple them because you'll flip them long edge. But I am Lois Burleson. I'm the district nurse in Wiley School. Carissa, I took this spot. She moved on to Rachel Parkinson. Basically, I just want to tell you my little four caps thing for our starts with the school nurse as far as like what we do with school health. We're the medical professionals in the district other than the LSSPs. There's eight nurses in our district. We have four RNs and four LVNs. The RNs are, well, there's me, obviously, at the high school. There's two at the junior high, one at the early child. And then we have two elementary LVNs and two, or about to have two intermediates. So two intermediates, and then right now we have an extra LVN that's helping with COVID. So that's what the district thought was great. And I love the way it's set up because if you look where the RNs are, which I'll talk about here in just a second, the difference between them, if they're at a great, they're at great campuses where they can do the most intervention, if you will. So the difference between the RN and the LVN, the RN is allowed or is able to do comprehensive assessments. We can nursing diagnose, we can write care plans, we can take the information that we receive from the student, the doctor, the parent, whatever, and gather that information, action plans, and we can write the, what we need to do with it. What the student needs to come every day at this time for medication. The student needs to come to the nurse every day and check, you know, blood sugar level, whatever their condition may be. An LVN can do those same things, but they can't initiate that care plan. They just can give us the information, say, hey, Lois, I have a student that's going to be a diabetic. They're going to do their, this is their ratio, this is their medication. This is what the doctor's orders say. I'm going to initiate that, but you write the care plan how it can mirror with that doctor's plan. And then the whole school, whole community, whole child model, that's a SHAC thing. Y'all have it in your packet thing. There's the 10 components on it. This year we're focusing on 8 components with the curriculum that's coming along the way. And then I went ahead and gave y'all the handout about the difference between it, if you want to read the exact specifics between the RN and LVN. Not everybody does, but sometimes that's information. And then how school nursing looks in America's public schools. Majority of them, close to 70%, are RNs. And they like that because they have that extra layer of education, right? It's kind of like how Mr. Reston was talking about the LSSPs. There's a counselor, and they can be an LPC if they choose to be. But with the school psychologist, they have that extra education and that next level, next layer. And that's kind of where that is with RNs and LPNs. Next is all about the students. A little funny. Daily visits. I was going to let y'all know that what we do, I printed a stat. I didn't share with everybody. But I would let you know that this was as of last Friday. We have seen, this is campus or district-wide, we have seen 10,704 students in the district. Now, that's not 10,000 each student, obviously, but obviously repeat offenders. And so, anybody guess what the number one reason that kids come to my office? I'll give you that top three, but somebody guess the first. You don't get to guess. Chris is out.
Stomach ache.
Good job, yes. Stomach ache is number one, headache is number two, and sore throat is number three. Those are the top three reasons. We have 1,194 stomach aches as of December 10th. I think we really had 1,194 stomach aches.
I feel like I had that in my house.
So, anyways, and then 1,090 headaches and 920 sore throats. So that just kind of gives you an idea of what kiddos we're working with.
That 10,000 number, is that for the year?
That's from the beginning of the year, August 18th, until last Friday.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that, does your number count medication?
That's two visits per child.
That does not count medication.
So that's not actually you also add all your daily med visits.
Oh, that's not in there?
So,
no. That's just that they came down to the office, they were sent to you or what. As far as that, you know, that's coming ongoing. On each campus, for instance, I can speak on mine for sure. I went ahead and looked at everyone else's as well. I have 10 daily medications I give and one diabetic that I send. So no matter what happens, I'm for sure going to see 11 kiddos every single day, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it can be, right? Like, I want to make sure that they have enough meds. I want to make sure they took the med. I want to see, make sure, you know, all the things that they're doing. The West Junior High, they do 13 meds and a diabetic. East Junior High does 10 meds and a diabetic. So we're all kind of roughly around the same. Right now, West Elementary, she's only doing 3 daily meds. And that's okay, because she's a newer nurse, so we're good. And Wiley East Elementary, which is probably our biggest population, not probably, it is, she does 14 daily meds, and she does not have a diabetic at this time, but she does have a student that does catheterization, but the student doesn't want that she would have to be available to assist. So, I mean, elementary, you know, they probably would like to get some help. So that's that. And then that's not including, so that's just the daily prescribed that the doctor has sent us an order, the parent has asked us to do the medication. We also have what we call PRN meds, which stands for as needed meds. Let's say a baby's coming in for a headache frequently. Parent can opt to bring them, they gotta leave work, right? They gotta tend to the headache and they'll keep coming. We allow them to bring as needed medications for the district. They come in, they bring us an unopened bottle of Tylenol, Advil, whatever the headache gets in us. We make a big deal about that, nurses do. And then they sign a medication authorization form they complete for us to say, yes, you may administer this medication to my student as they need it. We typically, especially younger levels, age groups, we contact the parent prior to administration. And that's just we want to make it fail safe, right? If I give your child medicine at 2 o'clock, they get home, it's kind of like Mr. Bethan said, oh, it's great. They're not going to remember that, and then they're going to have a headache. We don't want to give the dosage too soon. So high school is not, I mean, if I know the student's a repeat student case by case, but especially elementary, they contact parents and say, hey, they got a headache. Are you okay if we give them this medication? This is the time I'm giving the dosage. So they know that. And then, of course, already said the authorization to administer. That's really important because we don't, especially high school, yeah, every kid's going to say, my mom doesn't care. But I care if your mom cares. And we don't know where that is. We're kind of in the middle. So it's really important, and I'm sharing that with y'all's community, so if you ever talk to somebody, oh, make sure you sign that medication administer form. It's a protection thing for your student, for us, and for you as the parent. So some of the other things that we do as nurses is we take care of acute and chronic conditions. Sometimes people don't understand the difference between acute and chronic. So acute would be like their sore throats, their allergies, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea for that day. Chronic conditions would be the diabetes, seizures, asthmatics, food allergies. Those conditions aren't really going to go away, and we're going to try to address it for student safety the entire school year and help. Care coordination, the way that helps us is, again, goes back to when they have a chronic condition. I'll play with asthma here. We want the parents to get that information to us from the doctor. Calling us and saying, my student's asthmatic is not, we need more. We need doctor's note. Can they self-carry their inhaler? Do they need to get breathing treatments? Such like that. It's just communication. Then, of course, we're going to coordinate with the parents. With the parents, the doctor's offices, sometimes you have to call the doctor's office. We may not be able to read their writing and say, hey, we just want to make sure that that's good. Attempt to contact parents first, but if we can't, we get a hold of physicians. And we have that flexibility, professional, to do it. Counselors, we coordinate with the counselors. Kids are in there and they're complaining about headaches to the counselors. Hey, send them to us. That's our job. We'll check them out, make sure they don't have fever, nothing else going on, history of migraines, etc. And then, of course, we do a lot of patient education. I had a kiddo today come in and educated, and they're like, my stomach has been upset, but it's been going on for 3 days. Okay, what things are you doing? You know, sometimes that's enough for the kiddos to say, oh, I didn't know that there's certain foods that I could eat or certain foods that I should consider or whatever's going on with them on that. Crutches, a kid twists their ankle, we educate them how to use crutches. Some of them have no idea how to walk with crutches. On to more than seeing 6 students. So that's all of us doing our day-to-day things. In addition to that, we don't just see the kids that are sick, ill, all that. We also have to do screens. That's a state thing. We have to do vision, hearing, and scoliosis screening. We notify you that, especially on scoliosis screenings, that we're planning to do that. That's 5th grade girls and 8th grade boys. We screen them, including vision and hearing. We screen them initially. We have to wait 2 to 3 weeks to rescreen the student if they fail. And then after that, we refer them. We send you a letter that says, hey, Josh, he failed his vision screening on September 20th. We rescreened him October 11th. He failed again. We just want to give you a heads up. We have to report to the state by June of that current school year, the end of that school year, to say what we did for that student. So it's really important when we send that information out. We want you to. We, in fact, even give you the form that says, take this to the doctor, let them show our results, let the doctor screen them, just give us the information back. We chart it. Hearing the same way, screen them, we have to rescreen them. Another thing we do is flu clinics. They do an annual flu clinic. McCoy's Pharmacy's been doing it for like a million years, I believe. We do it for the staff. So part of an employee wellness thing. We're looking to do, I don't think, did y'all do one? Since I came in September, I don't know what they did.
Yeah, the health department
came
in to.
Okay, so they try to do, yes, required vaccinations. Because I haven't even gone for that one. So immunizations is kind of a big deal with us because we, you know, that's not us. That's Texas law that says the students are required X amount of vaccinations and they're on a schedule, right? They don't just get one shot of the vaccine. Some of them are 3, 4. Occasionally 5, and then some are 2. So we want to try to also do that. And they had health department, you said.
They did it with their COVID vaccination. We had They could bring their kids in.
Yeah, they were going to do COVID, and then they said, hey, would y'all be interested in that? I'm like, yes. So,
yeah. So they facilitated that prior to me. And then Carissa had an awesome speaker come from HEB, which is a Region 14 meeting, and HEB has said, we'll come out. Their pharmacist said, we'll come out and we'll administer vaccines if y'all want us to. So, obviously, we don't do it in the middle of the school year, but you know, it's obvious. Beginning of the school year. Health education, nutrition, and chronic conditions, those are important, especially the example would be my diabetic kiddos, right? Make sure you're eating the appropriate things. You need to make sure your carb ratio to your insulin ratio is good. We don't want you to bottom out, but we also don't want you to shoot up, right? Because our job is to keep them in the classroom, right? And so if they're in my office because they're sipping water, checking ketones, I'm failing that student. Not just diabetically, but educating them. So that's an important thing. And then, of course, other things that we're involved in is the school health advisory committee. I'm here today talking about what we're doing. I also said, like, on asthmatics, we were teaching them the proper use of the inhalers and what triggers. A lot of kiddos, you'd be shocked that don't know what triggers their asthma. And so we go through that. That's part of our education process. Like, okay, what were you doing? Were you outside in the wind? That's a great trigger or something. But different kids are different triggers. So what can we do to help figure that out so you can be proactive and on the preventative side, taking your inhaler, whatever you need before school?
And then something like that, you have communication with parents too.
Absolutely. If I'm talking to a parent, especially at the beginning of the year, that's one of the main things I ask. Can you tell me what triggers they have? I document that information, and it's great because if the student comes into my office, I'm prepared. Oh, that's one of their triggers. Let's not forget. Food allergies. Some kiddos don't know certain things, certain nuts. Like one of my favorite is pesto sauce. That's a nut that's in there. Some kiddos don't know pesto sauce is like pine nuts, and they're like, oh, I didn't realize that. I'm like, listen, I'll do an EpiPen, but I don't really want to. And nobody else wants to. Mr. Vestal doesn't want to. Mr. Ryder doesn't want to. But I'll do it. And how to do that meeting. Some students do carry their EpiPen. We need documentation that says, hey, I'm going to carry my EpiPen. It just protects the student, the parents, and the nurses. And then ends with community, as y'all can tell, I'm talking with us, which is immunizations, making sure when your babies, the kindergartners especially, you keep your little foster baby, Josh, please. You're not going to get vaccinations, which you don't have to. You prefer you do. It's okay. Get your exemption form, right? You can do a medical exemption. You can do a lifelong exemption if the child had a reaction to anything. You can file a religious exemption with the state. Austin will send you a form. You complete it. It's good for 2 years. Otherwise, get their vaccinations and turn in that documentation. Then, otherwise, you don't get a phone call from me. Hey, your baby's not up to date. You really need to go to school. I'm going to call Mr. Resonance. Just kidding. I've never called you yet.
Yeah, no.
Not about vaccinations. Yeah, but not vaccinations.
I had a few.
That conversation just comes up.
Oh, no. I'm like, okay, take it back. Medications in and with the community is, it's really safer for kiddos to take medicine at home. You know, it's in your home, it was prescribed to you, and it's there. So oftentimes we get asked, well, they need that antibiotic in the middle of the day. can take it right after school, and we can take it right before they go to bed. And sometimes parents don't think about that. They're just not. They just say the bottle says 3 times a day, and then in the middle of their day is at school. Yes and no. So if they need it, we're absolutely willing to give it. We're trained in all that area. We signed up to do that. But again, it's safer at school. So parents were aware, hey, there's a chance that I can just keep it at home. Please do so. Health education, the healthcare assessment, that's where we come in and we assess, we do an intervention and follow up. Community helps with that. We deem that something needs intervention. Hey, so-and-so's been in my office every day for a headache for the last 5 days. They've taken Tylenol. Have you followed up with your primary care physician? Parents like, I didn't realize he came in every day for headache medicine. Absolutely, let me make an appointment. And then you can follow up to say, you know what, I'm glad we went into the doctor because, as a matter of fact, come to find out he bumped his head, he didn't tell anybody, that's why he's been needing the medication for 5 days. What do we need to do moving forward? And then the doctor can give us instructions. And then, of course, Shaq, we thank y'all parents for participating. Makes our job easy. And we also say that. And then again, the 10 components of the whole child health community, you have the chart in there that tells you, and school health is one of those components. And anyways, my last favorite thing is, I love this quote, it's from school nursing, which is students be health, must be healthy to be educated and educated to be healthy, right? So they need to be healthy in order to come to school and be successful, but we also need to educate them how to be healthy.
And one thing she left out that has been very critical is COVID.
I did.
And so I'm going to say,
it's ugly.
Carissa started and then Lois assumed that. So that was a monumental task that the head nurse of our district, our health director, which is what they are, we had to develop a plan March of 2019 during spring break, March 10th, of how, what, where, and then we, you know, all the protocols, training nurses, you know, how you answer the phone, what are signs and symptoms, and they can tell you.
No guidance, just,
yeah, it's just
and it changes every week.
You have to have a program. No guidance.
Yeah. It's like, all right, this is what the commissioner said this week, and this is what we're doing, and then you have to make sure everybody's on the same page. And just let me say that, you know, you don't think about the school nurse until there's a crisis. COVID was a crisis. When somebody goes down, whether it's a seizure or a high fever, whatever it is, you know, you have all these educated people in this building, and they all look for one person. Always. Me. That's who I've got. Nurse. You know, and that's what we depend on, and they're so valuable to our district in many ways, protecting your children, etc. But I can just tell you as administrator, Mr. Agnew, that's our go-to person, you know, like, where get the nurse? I know what to do, but I want the nurse. And
we work side by side. Our offices are in the same area. And during COVID, I get to work about 7:20. He's already been there much earlier than me. Every morning, he's answering phone calls COVID-related the second he gets there to Elise. I want to commend Craig, Carissa, and I'll put Lois in there now. She wasn't a part of the COVID.
I did my own in my other district,
yeah,
so I get
did.
It.
And Michelle March, yeah. They worked tirelessly, endlessly, just nonstop COVID-related, and I commend y'all for the job y'all did.
That's all we did for a long time.
Yeah.
Like,
being best at, we're besties.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like.
But I also commend admin because even from the district I came from, they were willing to recognize that that was a whole new entity, separate component, and they brought in, like, Michelle was able to just focus on COVID for us, and then they brought in a helper to do that. So that's to be committed to, because the district didn't have to do, they could have just been like, okay, and it's not our department, and they didn't do that. So
Craig would have to educate the administrators. The administrators have to
we
educate
have trained,
the nurses
we trained
and teachers.
All the time.
And then, as Carissa said, then they change it all. Yeah. It'd start all over the next week.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And so we were contact tracers, too, which is, you know, a little different aspect of the health part of it, and not a real thankful job, but Carissa took the lead role too, because, you know, at this campus, just think of how many close contacts you have, and although we have assistant principals that have that assignment, they're busy too, and a lot of times Carissa just had to assume that. Lois does too. She sees where, like, the health department wants that notification, they want that information within 24 hours, and she just did it. So all the information, the report I do every Monday goes to Health and Human Services, all comes out of Lois's office now, Carissa's starting. So who we have, new cases, when their start date, when their end date, all that information. They do, besides all this she talked about, she didn't even mention something that every day she has to do.
It's like an ugly word.
Yeah. We don't like talking.
We don't like talking about it. I did bring my information just in case somebody asked questions.
But you know, it's like, and I look at it. Chris can tell you, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm looking, I'm emailing, I'm texting them all in there. Like, do you not sleep? Please. You
know, who updates the portal?
Lois gives it to Jackie, and she does.
Have y'all ever seen that on our
webpage? Oh yeah. That's our active cases.
It's really helpful.
And the notifications and that. Lois takes care of that, and Jackie puts it out, and now we have it through each campus, does that. But we rely on that campus nurse.
Yes.
That's our go-to person.
Right.
You know, if there's like, well, my doctor's, you need to talk to the nurse, because that's the health professional, not the principal. The principal needs to know what's happening, but the nurse is our professional. And that's what we count on. That's a critical discussion when you say you can't come for 10 days or... You know, we don't make anybody's decision. This is just what happens. This is the different choices and what's going to happen. And, you know, we work really hard, and she, as an RN, she knows, you know, we're not doctors. They can't diagnose, but they can. An RN has a little bit higher level of expertise. And so we really look at a student after a year or two of COVID before, oh, you just got a runny nose, 10 days you got COVID. Or give me a test or an alternative diet. We really look and talk and set as long as we can and say, Mom, we have a free test. We can do it. It's non-invasive. We'll know, or you got to come get them and take them to your private physician or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we don't do it real. And so our nurses really had to work hard, because you got a lot of kids come in there with a runny nose and a stomach ache, and they're all signs and symptoms. And the symptoms are the same.
This is everything.
And it's in black and white. It says you must. Okay. It, you know, it wasn't maybe if you want to, school district. It was you must do this. And so that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think from a parent standpoint, the ways that you guys have handled that has really felt like an extension of these other things that you're talking about, ways to really, really be able to partner with families in a way that helps keep the students best in front of you, you know. So some people have decided that COVID's over, some people have decided that COVID is never leaving. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got everything in between.
Right.
To have the dashboard really helps kind of go, all right, but the actual numbers today look like this.
Uh-huh.
That helps us. That helps us to really
and I can tell you they're the one, the liaison between Wiley-ISD and Pender County Health Department.
Mm-hmm.
Quit laughing.
We won't say why.
Yeah, they need a lot of
I'm
buffer.
I'm laughing because I listened in on some of the meetings in a different district, and that was...
But yeah. Carissa and Lois do a great job with Annette and that group and getting their professional opinion. Amy Dreschenberg, who used to be the doctor there. So, just, you know, it was a learning experience for all of us. I was just glad we had someone there. When we have a continuity of operations plan, we have a communicable disease plan already in place, but how do we implement that? What does that mean as a district? And it all plays into that, and so it's good to have a health professional.
I commend and just really encourage education to go out as much as possible to parents, to teachers, and to the students. That's critical. Now, how much do parents read and listen? That's a different case. But having that out there and what's coming from the state and what it's not Wiley's doing this because Wiley wants to invade your time. No, this is a requirement that we're getting, and we have to do it. And there are some things that are we shall.
You've
do.
Been to the school board, and you know
right.
It's a must, or you shall,
yeah.
Or you may.
The one word changes must, whether or not the has to be done. So. I come into that. I mean, COVID was tough on everybody, but to have a bunch of germs running around in the school is a whole nother ballgame that a lot of people don't understand.
The interesting part is 50% of the people are happy and 50% are mad every day, and that changes.
No matter
what. It just depends what the call is and what you're doing. And that was a hard thing. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to finally get it right and everybody's going to be happy. It just never was like that.
Can't get
what, whatever it was, it was a...
In a unique position for us school nurses that I think sometimes people don't think about, and I get that because they're not walking, you know, that mom or she's this. You know, when teachers or even principals have an issue, they're kind of like, go next door. Nurses are, we're spread out, right? So we're, it looks, it's on the phone, you know, hey, on your campus. And then we're, both, all of us are dealing with different populations, right? Like, now I've used Krista because I know what she did, and so I can call her, she's right there. But we don't have that next door thing. And so if I call another campus, they're working with a different population. So school nurses really bonded in that, not just within their district, but, you know, state and nationwide, because we're just kind of the only person there, and we're kind of figuring out who we're seeing that we So, Grace.
Right.
That's all I have, guys.
That's great.
Thank you, nurse.
Thank you very much.
Two quick ones for you.
Yeah.
The vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So flu vaccine, things like tetanus, is that through you guys, or is that a doctor, send to your doctor kind of thing?
We typically send to your doctor. Any type of school vaccination we require, we would probably host those at the beginning of the school year.
Okay.
There are, like off the top of our heads, kindergarten and seventh grades who we report on, so we kind of, you know, zero in on those, so to speak. I mean, obviously we have... We're able to flag whoever is not, we call it out of compliance. But for instance, the tetanus, that would be a Tdap vaccination, go to your doctor.
So it'd be like a, but it's on the, I mean, if someone gets scraped by a, they're recommended to get the tetanus,
well,
you wouldn't administer that.
We wouldn't administer, and we wouldn't necessarily recommend it if they've received their vaccination according to compliance rules in the seventh grade, which is age 11 to 12. And tetanus, that component is higher in that. The vaccine is really DTaP, but then when they get to that age, it becomes the Tdap because the tetanus is the higher component. And tetanus is good for 10 years. And that's part of the reason that they implemented that. So by the time that they would likely need another one, they would already be out of school.
But to clarify, even if we do have vaccine clinics here, we don't actually administer.
No.
We just host it. So the school nurses
mm-hmm.
never give.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at this point, the
right.
school nurses are not giving.
But you're coordinating the folks
right.
to kind of the
we might bring them in
the,
to do it and set
pharmacist.
It up, but they actually do it.
Okay.
For
awesome.
Which is what we did with COVID too.
Right.
We just
yes.
facilitate. We
just
we said we have a facility. We'll help you with parking. We'll have security. Whatever you need.
We'll test you.
Yeah. Yep.
Which we do test, like at the PAC, but we test on each campus as well. So, I mean, it's very, you know, the availability is amazing if you want anything COVID testing wise.
This is my next one is a newbie question. So,
okay.
the education that you do, if someone comes in and is asking about, you know, a sickness that they have or even a sexual, do you, how far do you go before you give them over to a counselor?
That's a great question. Typically, like if it's like nausea, vomiting, something like that, nothing. If it's a sexual type thing, then I usually ask them where they're at with their parent before I go further discussion.
Okay.
Because I really, I think it's such a fine line. You don't want to overstep your boundaries, and you don't want to recommend or suggest something that you really don't have all the factual information on. We get blessed as school nurses where we have sometimes the pamphlets that can just give you the factual stuff. So that's what we're going to give. We're never going to give suggestion recommendations, and then we'll refer them out.
Okay.
If they have an open relationship with their parent, I always advise them to call their parent, talk to their parent, and I am not opposed for them calling their parent in my presence. If you want, get mom on the phone, and then usually I make it funny, and I say, whatever they've labeled their parent, like, hey, hey mom, this is the nurse, you know, and then go from there. I want parents. It's a partnership.
Yeah,
that's our
sure.
goal. It's a partnership. So
I would say it would just depend on the subject, because especially at the high school, I mean, I would frequently have, I don't know if she's had it yet, kids wanting pregnancy tests,
yeah.
you know, things like that. So I always, with that kind of stuff, refer back to the parent,
mm-hmm.
just because they need to be talking with them anyway.
Yeah, they're going to have to.
Well, and then you get, most high schoolers are not 18, but once they turn 18, now the parents, you can't call the parents.
Well, I still opt to call the parent, and let me tell you why, because they're still labeled as their guardian. You know, it would have to be a special situation, you know, where the student is their own label, but when they, and we proactively know that information up front. You have to register your student every year, correct? And so all that information is provided. Whoever's labeled as their primary custodial of care, that's who we refer back to.
Student, even if they're 18, I mean, like the ones that can drive themselves home, we still have to get their parent consent.
Absolutely.
Like just because you're 18, you can't just sign out. So they're still a student, even if they're 18.
Right. And it's protection for the student. I mean, ultimately.
So there's not like confidentiality, like if someone says, I feel sick and I want a pregnancy test, and you say, call mom, and they say, no, I don't want to.
I do involve the counselor at that point, and ask them if they've already spoken with the counselor. And if they haven't, I still go to the counselor, and because that their confidentiality is very similar to our confidentiality, right? Especially as a whole over the school district. And so then I discuss: have you visited with the student? Have you not visited with the student? And typically, it's worked out where that hasn't been an issue. I'm sure one day that will happen. How will I handle that? Mr. Bessant?
Well, schools are covered under FERPA.
That's
true. So a parent technically can request any records. And so I could call and say, I want all my kids' educational records, which includes the nurse's records.
Right.
So, I mean, technically, if you
know
put it, if you documented it, they would find
regulated
it.
Regulated by FERPA, more, not much HIPAA, but mostly FERPA.
Right.
It's a little different.
Mm-hmm. And you know, nurse as old as time, nurses didn't document it, didn't happen. And so we're going to document. I'm going to document you came in and you asked me the things that you asked and how we handled it. We have what we call our office visit reason, what our treatment was, what assessment we did, and then what our disposition was. And so that was kind of our three checklists to make sure, you know, we answered it, we didn't answer it, or what we did about it, the situation.
And that's kind of a fine line because, I mean, obviously, if they're in danger or putting, you know, there are things you're required to report, but you also don't want to ruin that relationship you have because you may be the only adult that kid can confide in, and so.
It's not like it's not all the time.
Yeah.
It's probably not a short conversation.
Right. Okay.
You guys are the moms of the school?
And we're held to that standard too. I mean, I hate it when you report it, and but we also have to, you know, if we felt that it was something that was a concern for that student, but, you know, it is hard. I'm not gonna lie, it's when the ones come in and say that, yeah, sure.
Great questions and great comments. Thank you very much. As I told y'all at the last meeting, we're required to have four SHAC meetings during the school year, so we have two scheduled in the spring, February 16th and April 13th. Those were selected by design. The February 16th meeting is going to be very important because we've been waiting for the State Board of Education to approve curriculum, and they have approved curriculum now. We'll be sending our health and PE teachers and myself out to Region 14 for a textbook fair in late January, and I will be bringing those resources to this meeting and other resources that we can gather and find. We've also been waiting for direction from TASB, and we still have not received that. So I was hoping at the January board meeting that our school board would adopt a policy to give us authority to look at textbooks, gather information, have public comment, open forum, and make a recommendation to them later on. But we're not there yet with TASB, so that's probably going to be closer to February, which is that meeting be before the February 16th meeting. So that's all working out in time-wise. April 13th is another important date because through EMAD, our instructional materials allotment, we can purchase the new materials, curriculum, and textbooks, and that's when we do that, is in April. Both February and April, we do have to have public comment, so we're making sure we're saying that on the recording day that people can come and voice their opinion on the 6th curriculum, which will be a part of our health textbook adoption. So looking forward to having those meetings. Once again, I appreciate your attendance here today. You're an outstanding committee. Does anybody have any other discussion, anything they want to ask or talk about before we adjourn? Okay, this meeting is adjourned. Thank